Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to Cinepile Podcast, the podcast that talks about films that matter. And like always, we're here to talk about significant films that we think are a little noteworthy, that we think shouldn't go into the dark. And we're going to keep it a little bit fast and loose with this one because this is our 0.5 episodes that come in between both of our more major ones. So we're just going to be talking about our typical recommendations if you've been listening to us for a long time, that we're just going to go through some of our personal recommendations. Kind of to kick it off, did you guys want to talk about yours or want me to lead things off?
I mean, I can kick it off, I guess. Okay. I was just thinking, you giving that intro, though, how long have we been doing this now?
I mean,
like, when did we start this?
A long time. Like, almost, like, we're coming up on almost 2.5 years.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, close to 3.
Near to 3
years. Because we were living in a different place. Yeah. And that's crazy to think about.
Yeah. I still remember that one day when I was walking down the hallway, and I was just like, hey, Neil. And you were like, what? And I was like, what do you think about the phrase, like, cinepile? And you were like, neat. And I was just like, okay, he likes it. Yeah, like validation. I was like, okay, just keep on hustling.
I was probably like playing video games at the time and didn't even hear you say it.
Neat. Anywho, back to Street Fighter. Almost 2.5 years, yeah.
Well, what's your film?
Yeah, what do you want to talk about?
Recommend?
Okay,
today?
I'll get into it.
Yeah.
Okay, the one I want to recommend is the one that totally got snubbed from the Oscars.
Ooh,
this year.
Oscar snub.
Yeah, total Oscar snub.
From A24, right?
Yes, I think. Actually, I don't remember if it was A24.
Was it A24 or Neon? I remember it was one of those two houses.
Shoot,
Cooper's got a Neil. Or he's got a Neil. He's got a thing
he
for
does
A24.
Have a Neil.
I do have a thing for A24. Here, you and talk
Neil.
About it. I'll look it up.
Okay. This is Florida Project. This is Sean Baker. Many of you might know Sean Baker. He did in 2015 Tangerine. That
Excellent
blew up
movie.
Yeah. Shot all on iPhone. That had like a small, like, you know, micro budget, and it was just incredible.
Good story.
Yeah. It was good storytelling. It was, yeah, like a classic like comedy but wrapped in a modern kind of shell. A24.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, A24. Whenever you see fucking A24, you know, come up on the screen,
yeah,
you expect greatness.
Yeah.
Coming out of, I don't know what it is,
oh,
but
it's kind
they've
of
been crushing it lately.
On their website, it has like their whole index of all the films that they've done. And I was just like, and I remember we kind of went on an A24 like tear for a hot second at one time, and I was like, and I was like, man, and I was
like
almost
Mojave.
An A24. Yeah, I mean, they've had some stinkers.
Mojave was a stinker.
Yeah, but nonetheless, they've always pushed things to get into that weird, and they've gotten to that uncomfortable zone.
It's worth
know?
Giving a
yeah.
shot.
Yeah, so it's like there's going to be some duds for sure, but A24 has always pushed it. But you were kind of talking about how does Florida Project kind of adhere to
yeah.
pushing things? Or
well, Florida Project is, when I was watching it, it was my kind of movie. I think last episode I was talking about like movies that I like are the ones that like I can feel something. And like I was like, oh, La La Land. Like it was just in my gut. I know this is a good movie. This is Florida Project. That is like to the T. It's just, you just feel something watching it. There's some sort of like soul in it, like some sort of storytelling that's like just beyond surface level, just beyond what you're watching. And it deals with children. And I've always had kind of a like a soft spot of like wanting to make films or like films that deal with real life issues, but are kind of centered around kids. And they kind of tell the story like in the periphery from their lives that they are unaware of what's kind of happening around them. Yeah, that's kind of like the gist of Florida Project. I know you guys haven't seen it, and
no.
I really don't. Like, I know this is a show that we spoil
together.
And, you know, like, not that we try to spoil things, but we talk about things. But I don't want to, like, talk about it too much since you guys haven't seen it. But Willem Dafoe is in it, and he is phenomenal.
Yeah.
He's nominated for it, as he should be.
Because I know, like,
for supporting actor.
Because I know, like, some of the premise, and I don't want to spoil things either, but Willem Dafoe seems to be some kind of influential character on these children and helping them in some kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, we can talk about this movie and not, I don't need to worry about like it not being a good movie. Like, it's not M. Night Shyamalan kind of, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's the manager of a a motel, like kind of an extended stay motel. That's where like the whole movie almost takes place in like a couple, like two blocks, like, you know, and it's mostly at this motel that these people live in. It's kind of like last resort kind of people down on the luck, downtrodden folk, kind of an image of what like 2017 America is to a lot of people. And it's just outside Disney World in Florida. So it's okay. Kind of like magic and, you know, just outside of their grasp kind of thing. I don't know. It's very good. It's very good.
Would you say like between like Tangerine and Florida Project, do you see kind of like any like parallels between the filmmaking or anything like that?
I'd say there's a stark contrast to the filmmaking, at least. The storytelling is very similar, where as far as Tangerine is about transsexual, like prostitute, essentially. and this is about like people living on the edge of complete homelessness, essentially. You know? So it's kind of like two lives that maybe we don't think about a lot, but, and they're also very like, Tangerine was a comedy. I mean, kind of dark comedy, but like it was still very serious and kind of honest about people's lives. And this is no different. It's very sincere about the kids and the people that live here. But the actual filmmaking is quite different because Tangerine shot all on iPhone 5s and this was shot on film, 35mm.
Anamorphic?
I don't think so.
No?
Shoot, I can't remember now. Actually,
maybe that was just the feel of the trailer to me, because when I remember seeing it and feeling that it was like, it was just so wide.
You know, it probably must have been. I don't know why that's not sticking out to me. I think probably because when I think of it, it's a super vibrant film. Like, it's incredibly colorful.
It looks
and
really
it
colorful.
Uses, like, specifically, it's, you don't see many films that, like, it's, like, primary color throughout is, like, this purple. Kind of an ugly, like, candy purple. And
that's fantastic.
Yeah. So it's just like in this, you know, everything is super green and the skies are very, you know, vibrant.
That's Florida.
Yeah. So a thing that's really similar to Tangerine is that it uses some like non-actors as primary characters. Like the lead in Tangerine, it was the first time that person's ever acted. It's kind of just real people. And in Florida Project, the mom, essentially one of the lead characters, it's her first time acting. She's like this heavily tattooed, kind of like almost trashy looking woman, but that's her in real life basically. And she was just perfect for the role and she crushed it. Like she's actually a really good actress. And mixing her with like Willem Dafoe is like, it never seemed like they didn't belong together. Like it didn't take you out of it at all either. I don't know, it just blended really well.
Just seemed really natural for them to be involved.
So I still am incredibly excited to see this film. Why do you think it was snubbed? Politics? Is there something with the film?
Because there's even a blank spot
within
the standings. And they could have easily slotted Florida Project in there.
I honestly have no idea. I don't know. Maybe it's just no one else had this gut reaction that I did to it. That it was just, there was some like oomph to it or something and no one else felt it. I can't believe that though, including or especially considering some of the movies that got in over it. I was very shocked, not to belittle other movies, but, and that they had a free spot that they could have added any movie and they didn't even choose to add it. So I don't know if there was something political or just it went under the radar and people didn't really see it. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be politics. I really don't quite understand how it all works, but yeah, an empty spot, and you had a film like Florida Project, or maybe Lost City of Z that we talked about.
Or Blade Runner.
But that's part of the problem with the Oscars, and you get into this comparison, like, better or worse between two films that might be just completely different. But yeah, any final words about Florida?
I would say that it was probably... It's probably number two favorite film of the year. For me, number one probably being Blade Runner.
Yeah,
they're vastly different. They're like so crazy different, but they both made me feel and think, and I don't know. Yeah, I got the most out of those two films this year, so that's why I got to give a shout out to it, you know.
So where do you think it would kind of land on your, on the old Anderson scale?
For me, probably an 8.5.
8.5?
8 to 8.5. Because it's like
a strong rating.
It's a strong rating. It's my kind of film, you know. Okay. It's like, that's the kind.
I'll definitely check it out because I really, really did want to see it. I think it's maybe up for a rental now, but if it is, I'll make sure to put that description down below. Florida Project, A24.
Yes, very solid.
Yeah, who's the director again?
Sean Baker.
Okay, cool. For sure, I want to check that out. Kyle, did you want to talk about your film? Or?
Yeah, sure. So I think we might have mentioned it briefly, but I returned from Prague. I had been living there for about like 6.5 months, 7 months. My recommendation did win Best Picture. It was shot almost entirely in Prague, and that's Amadeus. And what kind of makes Amadeus unique is reading through the trivia is it was one of the least successful or least seen Best Picture winners.
Interesting.
From like the list of nominees. I don't know if it was compared to every nominee ever, but from that year, it was seen the least of all the nominees. And it kind of makes sense because it's, I think the director's cut is verging on 3 hours. It's like the regular version is 2 hours, 40 minutes, and it's all about Mozart and his rival. So it's not what you would expect people to be rushing out to the theater to go see. But it's a really special film.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a classic for a reason, you know?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
What is it that you think makes it a classic?
Well, I think the story is archetypal, and it's told kind of like one of his previous films, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, from the perspective not of the main character. But in this case, we're hearing the story of Mozart from his rival, from the person who feels responsible for his death. And so you get into all these ideas or themes about like jealousy and rivalry and the beauty of music. Some really big topics that it handles extremely well. You know, handles it not just with an engaging story, but intelligently, I would say.
Okay.
And then the pace is something I really appreciated too, because I hate when things are rushed. I really do. And to have a film just kind of unfold in this way over 3 hours is kind of like, I love the pace of Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I like that. I fall into a film like that. And
Lost City of Z.
Yeah, I fall into Amadeus and Lost City of Z and these films that give me the space to like really get into a scene, to not cut me short, to not feel like a music video. But even less about the editing, it's like it's got real meaty scenes. Like these scenes could be laid out on note cards and you get the gist of the story. I don't think there's really like a wasted scene within that 3 hour runtime. So yeah, and I mean, you should just go see it if you haven't seen it already. It's been out for a long time. It's almost completely filmed in Prague, and Prague stands in for Vienna. And a little trivia about that was the people in the Czech Republic, what was at the time it wasn't even the Czech Republic, actually. It was part of the Russia? Austrian Habsburg Empire. They appreciated Mozart more than Austria and Germany. They had
parades
through
the
street, like funeral marches at his death, when there was like just a couple strangers and people at Mozart's actual burial. And Mozart claimed to have loved Prague, and he wrote a couple of his famous symphonies there. And so Miloš Forman, the director, incredibly famous, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, People versus Larry Flint, he is a Czech director, and I think you can feel the passion for Mozart's music. I don't claim to like go in my spare time and listen to his entire catalog.
Pop on a vinyl.
Yeah, pop on a Mozart vinyl, but I don't...
Well, what would you say about, like, because obviously, like, you know, using that back set of Prague and, like, you know, that very much so unchanged landscape, in terms of, like, you know, the cinematography and how they preserve that. I mean, did they, because I haven't seen Amadeus. Yeah. I've seen snippets of Amadeus, and it does look to be like, you know, a beautiful film, like on the same kind of scope of like Barry Lyndon or something like that. What would you say in terms of just like the cinematography and everything?
Well, in terms of the cinematography, although they didn't have, you know, Kubrick's NASA-designed lenses, it's kind of similar to Barry Lyndon in that they only built, I think it was like 4 sets. And in a 3-hour movie, that's very little, and almost all of it takes place in actual locations. So a lot of the symphony scenes, or a lot of the opera scenes, rather, take place in the opera house in Old Town Prague, where Mozart actually first performed, I want to say it was Don Giovanni, his opera. And so it's almost all actual locations, art designed and with actual furniture and pieces, like, you know, of life from that era. And as such, because they were moving through natural locations, almost all of it is natural light. It's all window light that they just diffused with sheets of diffusion. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's like, it's an inspiration in that, because you have no excuse to get, like, they just used daylight. There was often just natural light that they were manipulating.
And it's beautiful.
To get, yeah, an absolutely beautiful image on what was probably incredibly slow film.
All right, what would you, it's a hard one to, hard one to rate. Where would you put it?
Yeah, where would you rate this classical film?
I watched it not long ago. And I think it has a lot going for it. And for it being so long, I always, whenever I've put it on, I get drawn in. And I think that says a lot about the film, its rewatchability. So it's just, it's all around entertaining and smart and beautiful. So yeah, probably like 7.5.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Okay, so I have to check out Amadeus and Florida Project.
Yes, but you do.
There's one movie that we've all seen, which is my recommendation. And that's The Shape of Water by Guillermo del Toro.
Yes.
Cue music.
2 Oscar season movies.
Yeah, 2 Oscar season movies.
1 nominated for Best Picture, 1 not.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I think what I liked so much about it is what I hated about the trailers. It gave away so much. And that's why I was just so pleasantly surprised. There's actually a lot more to discover with a movie. So for those who haven't seen it, Shape of Water pretty much follows this woman, Elsa, who discovers a river monster from the Amazon, similar to the swamp monster from like the 1960s kind of genre, but, you know, revivified.
Or even earlier than that.
Yeah. 1940s, I think, is when it was far back, 1950s.
The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon. Yeah, look that up. And so, yeah, it's a retelling or an homage to the Creature of the Black Lagoon, and also a surprising romance.
The romance went pretty far.
Yeah, the romance went pretty far.
It was further than I thought it was going to be, for sure. That was a surprise to me.
Well, and I thought it was just, it did such a good job, because, like, they had, like, such a good ragtag crew, because you had, you know, Sally Hawkins, who was playing, you know, a mute woman, and then you had Richard Jenkins, who was playing Giles, who's her... you know, suppressed homosexual artist neighbor who, you know, can actually sign and everything like that and can actually communicate with her. And then it was Octavia Spencer, who plays Zelda, who's a black woman who is living in this world. And so they're all like kind of like this misfit bunch trying to get by in this kind of world. And you get to have all these like fun vignettes, well, not fun, but sort of these sad little vignettes of their own personal struggles that are so well peppered in with the rest of the narrative of the film that never detracts from it, but really just only builds the character, which builds the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a rarity in a lot of films, to where like they try to make side characters interesting by giving them their own subplots, and it always seems to detract from the film in both pace and in meaning. But it just made you kind of just root for them a little bit more and to better understand them like you do people and really humanize them. And as far as humanizing, like, kind of one of the more shocking scenes, I guess you could say, was kind of from the get-go. There was a lot of nudity with Sally Hawkins' character,
right, and
as well as a pretty intense self-pleasuring that occurred with splashing of bathtub water. But I mean, at first it was kind of jarring because you don't see that very often. But I liked it in the fact that the sexuality really humanized her in a lot of ways. It gave her passion, it gave her romance, it gave her a more three-dimensional kind of quality to her.
Humanized her, yeah, for sure.
And I don't know, like, because you could have just easily painted her as this, like, sad sack person who just gets kicked out of life and she's just quiet, and because, I mean, obviously because she's mute. But to make that decision, I think, was just really, really smart and just allowed you to just kind of pull yourself out of your own kind of ideas that you would have toward her and really see her for the person that she was, which I thought was just really great. And then something else more notable about the film while I was reading before we started the podcast was how it's only $19.5 million film, which was, for people who don't know budgets, that's pretty shoestring for big Hollywood budgets. I mean, when you're talking like, you know, Michael Shannon's in it and Sally Hawkins and, mm-hmm. you know.
That's pretty small.
Yeah, well, just look at his previous film, Pacific Rim.
Yeah, I wonder what that had.
Don't even need to look that up.
Probably $125 million.
And this one had, like, incredible production quality.
Right.
All around.
And that was actually, so Guillermo del Toro used to be a special effects, like a practical special effects artist in his early 20s in Hollywood. And so, like, that's where he kind of had a lot of love, I guess, toward early monster films and stuff, like the prostheses and all that kind of stuff. And this is his big, like, mwah, this is his big kiss to that old Hollywood style. And the shoestring budget kind of made him have to get creative. So that intro scene where it's that slow motion, where it's going through that tracking shot that, you know, all goes from underwater mm-hmm. to that was all practical. There wasn't any CGI that occurred within that shot at all. The only CGI that took place was actually the removal of wires and everything else. Like, but aside from that, they filled the room with smoke, then they projected through water, a water pattern through water as well to kind of glean that light effect as well as the texture of the water. Then they had everything else on strings, had the actors up on strings, had fans that would give the texture of water, would have like slow spinning fans for everything. And then also just slowed it down. So that's, and all of those kind of elements in conjuncture made it for this really, you know, this really nice thing. I mean, he did say that there was some CGI like debris and like bubbles that were put in there, but he said for the most part, like that's like a 90% practical shot, which I thought was,
that's impressive.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy impressive.
Which sells it even more.
Well, it's so impressive that I'm skeptical.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. I kind of am too.
I read it on the internet, so it's real.
I read it in the Reddit comment section.
Yeah, yeah. And then even kind of talking about Florida Project and how much color was used, I think Shape of Water was another good film in terms of color. Because, yeah, like, just
very
the use
comparable
of,
to, yeah, La La Land as far as, like, mm-hmm. set design.
Same kind of,
like,
palette, yeah.
Well, it's not the same kind of palette, but it's a very deliberate palette.
Yeah.
That's... I don't think you'll find a shot in the entire film that doesn't have that specific green that's like prevalent throughout.
Teal.
Yeah, it's not teal. Just teal. It's not really teal. No, though,
yeah, it's a variety of like aquas and cyans.
Yeah, aqua
and,
maybe. Is it, yeah. Yeah, but like it's in probably every shot in that film.
Mm-hmm.
They purposely have it somewhere in there like to draw your attention. So yeah, it's very deliberate color scheming.
Yeah. Well,
very deliberate color, very deliberate design. Of everything.
Yeah,
apparently everything in Sally Hawkins' apartment was curved and smoothed and organic shaped because to replicate that of water, which, again, you don't really get to have that kind of throughput in terms of design, everything like that. And what's great about that is, cool, I get to watch this a second time and I get to note these other parts of the art that get to take place because some director actually gave a damn to make sure that there is artistry occurring on every single tier of the film. Mm-hmm. And like, and you know, so they didn't really have a lot of extended CGI. They went full for it, you know. They I think they just really, their one of their main goals was to have practicals occur. But you know, and then at the same time, like, talking about how honest and true kind of the film was, and I know we're getting short on time and I could talk about this film, that the deliveries by all the actors just were very, very down to earth and just like big tip of the hat to Michael Shannon, because that dude acts his pants off. It's fantastic, and yeah, it's wonderful. Really, and but again, I think just Sally Hawkins steals the show, because she doesn't speak a single lick, and she breaks my heart like several times in that movie, and she makes me root for her, and like I can hear her, even though I never get to hear her voice, and like in just the acting. That she has like these humanist kind of just expressions that she can create with her hands when she just reaches for something, that she can just have that hesitance that, Shape of Water, I don't know. It really struck me. And because they have so much depth and style, it's something that I would easily want to see again, because there's something to be seen again.
And yeah, I would say maybe next to Blade Runner, it's probably the most visually appealing movie of this season. Over this past like Oscar season, that's those two, I think.
Nothing else really comes to mind. I would need to sit down and look at the list again, but I mean, there's no doubting that this is visually a feast. They didn't hold back, and it's so fun to watch. Just like with La La Land, what we're talking about, it's just so fun to watch a film have fun with its visuals. Like you can tell they delight in these visuals and building like this Cold War laboratory and the tanks for the creature, and
there's a lot of love.
Yeah, there's so much love there, and it's a nostalgic love. I think there's a lot of comparisons to be made with La La Land, honestly.
What would you rate this?
I'd rate an 8.
Yeah.
Because I would easily watch it 3-4 times. Like, because I think that I would I think when you watch a movie and you get to receive an education from it, it was a spellbinding and masterful film.
Yeah, it was crafted. Yeah, for sure.
Crafted. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent word to put it as. But so easily, Shape of Water. Check it out. Guillermo del Toro. He crushes it.
Cinepile approved.
Cinepile approved. That's that steamy stamp that just hit the movie.
Just hit that cover.
Do you have anything else you want to add to it?
I could go on and on, but honestly, you know, see it. Yeah, just kind of in closing comments, because I know we're kind of running short on time, but I would say the how sexuality is treated in it is very good. How characters are debased and kind of exalted are very interesting. So I think there's, again, like I said, there's a lot of layers to it, and it's something to watch. Even on like a simple commercial level, I think you can love it on a commercial level. And I think on a person who really loves film, I think that you can appreciate a deeper meaning. So
it's the kind of movie you could take your parents to, and I think they would enjoy it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
You know, it's a good general audience film, as well as being a filmmaker's film, you know? Yeah.
100%.
I was just going to say, you know, with Sally Hawkins, the Best Actress nominees are really incredible this year. Sally Hawkins for this. I still haven't seen Lady Bird.
Yeah. She's what's her name?
Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah, Saoirse Ronan. It's like I never know how to pronounce that name.
But
she's really good.
Frances McDormand, and then Margot Robbie for I, Tonya.
Yeah, Margot Robbie was really good too.
Margot Robbie was so good.
Yeah.
And Frances McDormand was incredible.
Yeah.
And then there's Meryl Streep, but does she really need another award?
I haven't seen the post. Meryl Streep thinks she does.
She's not going to get it.
I don't think she will either.
It's too strong of a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really strong year.
They're going to give it to someone that's not Meryl Streep for sure.
Yeah. I'm having trouble deciding who I think.
Yeah.
Because it was all just incredible. Do we have to pick one? We don't. We just say they're all amazing.
They're all winners.
Or we'll just complain whenever they do pick one.
Yeah.
That can be fair. Well, I guess in review, so I recommended The Shape of Water by Guillermo del Toro.
I recommended Amadeus by Milos Forman.
And I recommended Florida Project by Sean Baker.
But as we come to a close, once again, thank you guys for giving us a listen. If you are listening to this, feel free to give us a like, subscribe, or if you could really give us a big help, you can go ahead and leave us a review on iTunes. We will read your review here on our podcast. But like always, guys, I've been Cooper Carr,
Kyle Montgomery,
and Neil Anderson.
And we'll see you guys next Friday morning with episode 22. You guys have a great one. Bye.
See you.